que han ido cayendo, en que venga la alegría.
Hi, I'm here, Eric Mann. I'm one of the co-hosts of Voices from the Frontline on your 4 o'clock KPFK Public Affairs Hour. I'm here with Cynthia Rojas, Manuel Criollo, who just returned as representatives of the Labor Community Strategy Center as observers of the Salvadorian election, and Jim Petras, a longtime analyst of revolutionary movements, especially in Latin America. Jim, I want to make a comment, turn it over to Manuel and Cynthia for a few observations, and then give you another round on this important conversation. I think that we all agree, and we all being a very small number of people, that there's no way that a group of atomized, powerless human beings sitting in a factory or sitting in a couch are going to get up once every 4 years and have a revolution at the ballot box. It's been shown that the electoral system as a whole is a disempowering, alienating process that, in fact, people vote to the right of their actual inclinations. I think what we've seen is the only times that elections have worked is when they're the almost adjunct of, end of, culmination of popular struggles in the street, where the society is virtually being torn apart by a civil war, and that civil war is reflected at the ballot box, where people then are able to overcome threats about remittances, threats about their immigration status. Many people have died for the right to vote if they thought the vote was an actual transfer of power. We've also all agreed that from the Italian Refoundation to the Italian Communist Party to the, you know, you name it, to countries all over the world, that leftists in power become more bourgeois parliamentarians than revolutionaries, that the parliament has never been the front lines of any revolutionary struggle. Having sort of put those out as agreements among ourselves, even if that's a very small subset of the population, we're also living in a time in history when, after 1989, without the support of the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China, a whole set of experiments are taking place, a lot in the Third World. And we want to be careful, speaking for myself, to not reject out of hand struggles which are, by their very nature, experimental. So, for instance, many of the things that you're raising today, I'm assuming that the FMLN is painfully aware of. So I thought we'd give Manuel and Cynthia a chance to make some very preliminary observations of the strengths as well as the problems or contradictions of the movements, and then give Jim Petras another round of thoughts after he hears their point of view. You want to start?
Well, you know, I think that James is saying are very important pieces to the puzzle, I think, about what would it look like for revolutionaries in Latin America to play an important part in people's lives. And I think one of the things that I take back from coming back from El Salvador was two things. One, on the level of what revitalized this party. If we look at the internal struggles that the FMLN had between, let's say, what they call the renovadores and which are sort of the renovators, or if you want to, you know, go and talk to them, like the revisionists and the orthodox, that all those debates were all interesting. But in fact, I would say that the number one thing that has pushed forward the FMLN was the healthcare strike in 2002, I believe, where, in fact, the healthcare strike was able to popularize and concretize for people what privatization looked like, what did the neoliberal agenda look like for folks that both pushed working class industrial workers, and it pushed even a segment of the professional working class, like teachers and certain intellectuals, to radically push back against privatization, that both the process of the privatizing of, you know, in other words, people felt it in their pocket when people were talking about eliminating and privatizing healthcare. People understood it in their pocket, the privatization of the electricity and water, you know, while Arena pushed, said, you know, this is going to be an efficient system, it's going to be a cheaper system. In fact, you know, an average household pays $40 to have a landline in El Salvador. It's extremely high. It's higher than what you even pay in the United States. And so I think in many ways they've revitalized the FMLN into a militant party where the struggle between the left wing and the right wing of the party, it extremely pushed emboldened the left in many ways inside the FMLN. And I think that is a positive piece. And lastly, I would say that in these last election, even though, as I said in my intro, that it was a defeat objectively, the FMLN was able to win 260,000 more votes in this last election. That from last year's election for the municipalities. In last year's election, in fact, they had won 50,000 more votes than Arena. And so it wasn't metaphysical that they thought they could win power. And I think that they were able to run to in the limits of what El Salvador is living in under a platform that was pushing for sort of national reconstruction and social services for the masses.
And I guess the only thing, or one of the things I would add, is from being in El Salvador during this historic elections. Of course, everything was extremely heightened as far as what you felt on the streets. So whenever we talk to working class people, lower working class, middle working class people, the conversation was around all of the issues that Manuel named. And it was extremely impressive coming from the United States, especially to see that high of a level of conversation around the political economic trajectory of a whole country, and that so many people, primarily working class people, were engaged in this. And this is one of the main things that the elections did, because as Manuel had mentioned earlier, it was very clear that it was a two-system debate. It wasn't Democrat or Republican. It was very clear that it was right and left. And so when we go to the marketplace, you know, the vendors, who are extremely working class folks, were debating with us about, you know, not debating with us, but debating against the Arena line around the anti-communism, the pro-privatization, pro-neoliberal politics. And as Manuel was saying, as far as what drove the FMLN to ride this wave of discontent was the mass movement around healthcare, and we know that that is what is going to be one of its main challenges, is to be able to sustain the popular movements and to sustain, for example, the leadership of those peoples like Dr. Guillermo Mata, who was the vice presidential candidate, but didn't come from the FMLN leadership. He was the head of a popular social movement against the privatization of healthcare, and he became then one of the main figureheads in this elections. And the night of the elections said, "I stand with Shafiq Handal and the rest of the FMLN party leadership in trying to carry out our national program through the 31 assembly peoples that we have in the National Assembly, through the mayoralships that we control in the urban cities, and through the popular movements that have aligned themselves with the FMLN." And essentially this would be one of the main challenges for the FMLN to sustain that movement, because yes, it's true, in 5 years, if you don't do any of that groundwork, then where's the 37% that voted for you going to be, much less the 51, 52, 53, 60% that you need to actually gain power?
And before I get to Jim Petras, I just want to let people know that you should start taking off work at 4 o'clock on Mondays and just tell your boss that you need 4 to 6 to listen to Voices from the Front Lines and then to listen to Susie Wiseman and Beneath the Surface, because, you know, any progressive employer would give you that two-hour break. At 5 o'clock today, Susie Wiseman's excellent show. She has Beneath the Surface. She's going to be talking to Naomi Prince and call Boggs on the economic and political shenanigans of the Bush administration and the neoconservative ideology behind it. That'll be at 5 o'clock today. So now back to Jim Petras. Jim, what do you think of those observations?
I think it's useful. I think all Americans should go to Latin America, and I'm not surprised at what they said. But what they note about Salvador, I think you can say for practically for all of Latin American countries in one degree or another, at one time or another, you're coming from the most backward political country in the world, the least politicized working class in the world, the most bureaucratized and corrupt trade union bureaucracy in the world.
You mean the United States?
Yeah, the United States.
Right.
So anything you see anywhere in Latin America, I mean, I've talked to thousands of peasants over the last 40 years, and it's very common for people that have been engaged in rural struggles to tell you all about agri-export business elites, who gets the credits, who gets the technical aid, the irrigation projects, etc. I mean, they take it in with their mother's milk. So I think this is not something new and revealing in Salvador. I think it's a confirmation of a continent-wide historical process there. And I think the big question in Latin America today is U.S. imperialism, both in its military form, its multinationals, its use of the IMF as an instrument for bleeding these countries out of hundreds of billions of dollars over the last 10 years. These are the vital questions, and I think people are astonishingly aware of it, whether they're market vendors, street peddlers, or unemployed youth. And the key question, I think, today is that the electoral machines of the left and the center-left in particular, I have not been able to implement the welfare program. I mean, to implement income redistribution, to renationalize some of the essential strategic public enterprise, to increase social spending in a significant way for health and education. You have to be a revolutionary. In other words, to be a reformer today, you have to be a revolutionary. And you can see that in Brazil with Lula. I mean, the left is so blind and deaf on what's going on in Brazil, it amazes me. Here's the guy that's paid out $50 billion last year in debt and totally abandoned agrarian reform. Working consumption power of the working class dropped 12%. Unemployment is at 21%. And this reactionary is running all over the place, finding money and begging the IMF to lower the surplus. It's 4.25, which is almost 40% higher than the surplus in Argentina. Now, you'd think in a country that's stagnating with negative growth last year, unemployment soaring to 21% in the Sao Paulo area, where 40% of industry lies, you'd think that he would not generate a surplus to pay a debt that can never be paid.
Right.
And yet you talk to people in NACLA and all the other journals, and they talk about Lula as some kind of progressive, some kind of social democrat, forward-looking leader. And it's just impossible to get to a larger public except on Eric Mann's program and explain to him Lula represents a huge defeat for the working class and peasants, and there are already a new splits from the party, and there'll be more coming. The public employees workers are on strike now in many parts of Brazil because he actually reduced their pensions by 30%, which no president in the history of Brazil was able to do, and he boasted about it. He considered working for the IMF a courageous act, and he called the previous presidents cowards for not implementing the IMF recipes. So the point is, when we talk about revolutionary politics, Eric, today in Latin America, it took an insurrection to start the process of recovering $40 billion, which was pilfered by Bank of America, Citibank, and the others in Argentina. I mean, just protecting people's savings, they had to have an uprising. I mean, that's not a very revolutionary change, is it? I mean, if you go to the bank tomorrow, you can't get your money out, not that it's a lot of money, Eric, but to pay that electrical bill, and you find the bank is closed, and when you go to Citibank and you ask them, they say, well, we're not responsible. That was a subsidiary, which is totally autonomous. And you say, hey, brother, listen, wait. They send the profits back to the home office. Why can't you recapitalize the bank? And they look at you cross-eyed, and they say, well, you know, bring it to court, in the United States, of course.
Well, I think, let me ask you this, if you think this is a fair overview as we tie up the end of the show, that I think that for all of us who were fortunate enough to live in the truly revolutionary period from, let's say, 1955, and I consider that both the Montgomery bus boycott and the Conference of Non-Allied Nations in Indonesia in 1955, to perhaps the defeat of the United States in 74, 75 in Vietnam, if you look at that 20-year period, the general balance of forces was very good for revolution. The Soviet Union, with all its many weaknesses, created both arms and certain countervailing power. The People's Republic of China had not yet turned on the people of Vietnam. There wasn't an effective united front between China and the Soviet Union to in some way curtail U.S. imperialism. There was the amazing Cuban Revolution that managed to and still manages to hold on as a beacon in the middle of virtual international encirclement. And there was a tremendous amount of revolutionary experimentation going on all over the world. Having worked in the United States throughout this entire period, certainly I would say by 1980, with the rise of Ronald Reagan, what we've seen is the virtual loss of any interest in revolution in the United States, that the question of that the liberals have become not even liberals, but corporate liberals, that most of the young people today, as you wrote about in your critiques of 501c3s and nonprofits and NGOs, have gone in the direction of, you know, trying to do the best they can to fight for specific people's needs. I think that we're in a period of re-experimentation on the left. And I think that, for instance, we just had Sue Branford on. I don't know if you know her book, Lula and the Workers' Party.
Yeah, I helped, actually. She was doing something on the MST several years ago.
Right. So when we had her, when Manuel and I had her on the show, and she said, well, what was the greatest thing that Lula did? She said, balance the budget or reduce the surplus. It was nothing about a redistributive even mandate. So if it took Lula three elections to stay out of power and a fourth to get in, and if the way he got in on the fourth time is to make a deal with the center and to break with his own party in terms of giving himself far more autonomy, the question to me as a historian is always, okay, he did that. So what is the left going to do? What are the independent social movements going to do?
The progressive changes, I think I mentioned at the beginning, there's been significant changes in and reversals of liberalism, liberal rulers, but they've all taken place through independent class mass movements. These are not multitudes that Tony Negri talks about. These are very specific classes. When the coca farmers began their struggle for livelihood against the military, against the right-wing rulers, they set in motion a lot of forces. In Cochabamba, the second city, they tried to privatize the water, and there was a mass uprising, and that curtailed it, even though the mayor of the city was no progressive. I mean, the city was stopped cold. In Arequipa, in Peru, they tried to privatize the electrical system, supply system. Again, there was a massive protest. A couple of students were killed, and they stopped that. And Fujimori was a dictator, a tyrant, backed by Washington and his Rasputin. There was an uprising in 2001. They got rid of him. And then the elections. They brought in this phony cholo from World Bank and Stanford, and he comes in and tries to deepen what Fujimori was doing in terms of privatizing the economy. And now he's got 7% popular support. He's on the ropes. So what I'm saying is this. Reforms are on the agenda today. But the way to get reforms is not through electoral politics.
But, Jim, I would end with this to be continued. I think that spontaneous mass struggles of the people have always been a critical component.
They're not spontaneous. They're organized.
All right. Organized insurgencies of the people. But if the people cannot develop political parties, if the people cannot develop democratic institutions that are controlled by some constituency, if every leftist goes into parliament and sells out, if we can never have an election, even with mass struggles on the bottom, general strikes, and actually take power, if when we always take power, we sell out, then I don't think that's a very hopeful alternative. And I think that that's the challenge for the left, is if some of these experiments are coming up short, it's the experiments, to me, that are worth the historical inquiry. So in that, I want to thank you, and we'll, as they say, la luta continua, and the struggle will continue both in this show and forever. Thank you very much to Alan Minsky, our producer who keeps this thing going. The brother on the Stan Mizrahi on the... Okay, who's been doing the mechanical work and the technical work. For Cynthia and Manuel, who have come back with such animo and such interest in the Salvadorian Revolution. We'll see you next Monday at 4 o'clock. At the 4 o'clock hour, Voices from the Front Lines. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Public Affairs on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond. Stay tuned for Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman coming up next.